This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we're going to look at the Science Comedy Festival, BAFEST, where the first prize goes to the scientist who can come up with the best bad science. But first, what holds the record for one of the longest known flights? It's not an airliner or a military bomber. It's a small songbird called the Black Pole Warbler, called by my next guest, a flying meatball. He and his team strapped a little knapsack on the bird to track it, and they published their findings this week in the journal Biology Letters. Bill DeLuca is one of the authors on that study. He's also an ecologist at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good to be here.
How long was that flight?
So it was about 1,700 miles, lasting up to 3 straight days.
Do we know of anything that does that? That fly that
you know, there are other birds, specifically shorebirds and seabirds, that fly for actually much longer distances. But what makes this flight really unique is the fact that this is a terrestrial bird. This is a forest-dwelling species. And most forest-dwelling migratory birds really don't like to fly over the water. They typically avoid the water at all costs, except for this one.
So it flies from where to where?
The birds that we looked at took off from the coast somewhere between Long Island and Nova Scotia and flew straight down until they hit land either in Puerto Rico or Hispaniola.
And why do you call it a flying meatball? with wings.
One of the strategies that allows them to do this is they become very fat. They almost double their body weight before they take off. They go from about 12 grams up to almost 20 grams. So they turn basically into these lean, mean flying machines where they're just fat, which is what they use for fuel, wings, and then their brain, which is what they use for orientation, and so much so that they actually absorb some of their internal organs that they don't need during migration, like their digestive system.
They absorb it? So what happens when they get to where they're going?
When they get to where they're going, their hormones kind of kick in that generate the regrowth of the organs that they need to stock back up with fuel, and they pick up where they left off.
Well, and then they make a return trip.
They do, but they don't take the same route back. One of the other things that allows them to make this long southerly route is they have really good tailwinds, so southerly winds on the way down, but those are not there on the way back north. So on the way north, they take a regular route, which most other migratory songbirds take, which kind of follows the eastern seaboard north up the United States.
Now, you strapped on little backpacks with geolocators onto the birds, and no GoPros on these birds, right?
I wish. They're not quite eagle size.
They're tiny. The GoPro would be bigger than the bird.
Yeah, many times.
And so you could track them as they went? Did you discover anything really cool about their flight?
Well, we couldn't track them as they went, actually. Because these devices are so small, we put them on the breeding grounds in 2013. Then they went, they did their migration, went to South America, came back up to Vermont and Nova Scotia, and then we had to recapture those same individuals to take the geolocators off to be able to download the information. So we didn't actually know what was happening until we were able to get them off the birds, download the data, and begin to look at it.
Are all the birds good at flying, or is there a success rate for these birds?
All the birds, you meaning all the black poles?
Yeah. I mean, do they all make the trip, or do you lose some?
Well, you know, their typical success rate is their annual survival over the course of a year is only about 50%, and most of that mortality, we think, based on some other studies, occurs during migration. Migration is a very dangerous part of their annual cycle. So 50% annual, that's not great.
Right. So what more would you like to know about these birds?
You know, this is, although it's one of the more abundant species, it's also a very fast declining species. And when we think about migratory birds, we really need to understand their entire life cycle in order to understand what be affecting their populations and causing some of these declines. So we really think this is probably one of the first steps to begin to understand and look for some of the causes of these pretty dramatic population declines.
Bill DeLuca, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
We're going to take a break and come back. We're going to take a break and come back and talk about mercury. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Scientists have known that the surface of Mercury is dark. It doesn't reflect much light, but they have never been sure why. But a team of researchers has suggested a novel culprit, cometary carbon. They say passing comets may have spewed dust all over the surface of the planet on their close encounters with the sun, making Mercury kind of like an ashtray of the solar system, and perhaps a diamond-studded ashtray. They reported their findings this week in the journal Nature Geosciences. Peter Schultz is a co-author on the study. He's also a research professor of Earth, Environment, and Planetary Science at Brown University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you very much.
Is it fair to say that Mercury is like an ashtray for those passing comets?
Yeah, it is. But, you know, it also is a little different than just simply putting the ashes into the tray. This material is coming at very high speeds. And yeah. So it's more like hypervelocity painting.
So it's dropping carbon at very high speeds. And from my old chemistry set, if you smash carbon into something, you might get a diamond.
Sure. And actually, there's one more step before that. The cometary material has organics in them. Yeah. But then at these very high speeds, it turns to carbon. And in addition, with additional impacts, you actually may create these nanodiamonds. It happens. We find this on the Earth with impacts. And it's been actually experimentally produced. And so it's likely that across Mercury, there'll be a very small fraction that could be these little nanodiamonds.
Wow. So we know that Mercury is airless. So how would the comet dust get spread all over the planet?
Well, every time these small particles are actually left over from the tails of a comet. So Mercury passes through this tail, and these things slam into it. Then they're ejected, and they get spread all across the surface.
And so why doesn't this happen to Venus or the Moon? Why don't we see this kind of stuff?
Well, Venus has an atmosphere. It just simply gobbles it up. In the case of the Moon does it, but in fact, we don't have as much cometary dust hitting it as we do on Mercury. We have about 50 times the amount of material hitting, say, the Moon, 50 mm-hmm. times hitting the Mercury than we do have for the Moon. So the Moon gets some. In fact, there are some materials on the Moon that looks like they've trapped some of it. But Mercury is getting more than its fair share. Most something like 90% of the material hitting Mercury will be this cometary material.
I'm fascinated because, you know, when you make a prediction about things in science, you have to try to go out and test that prediction. But you can't do that with Mercury, so you tried something here on Earth that is even more wacky than that.
Yeah, so we used a really high-speed gun at the NASA Ames Research Center. This is my co-author, Megan Brooks-Sayal. And we slammed into a lunar regolith, a simulant, a sort of a proxy. And we saw what the color and reflectivity it had. And then we did it again, but this time we added sugar. And sugar is just a replacement for some of the complex organics that we might find in carbonatory dust. And sure enough, it turned really jet black. And that gave us an idea that suggests this is actually an operating process.
Does the darker surface affect the temperature, or, you know?
Yeah, it could. It could. But we know that, you know, the temperature on Mercury is over 800 degrees Fahrenheit, much higher than the temperature that's needed to melt lead. So it's a terrible place to be. And yet, in spite of it all, the poles of Mercury may have some more of this dark material trapped up there along with water ice.
Yeah, because we had the MESSENGER, right, detected water.
Yep. MESSENGER detected, and there were radar observations from the Earth that also suggested it. And I think this all goes hand in hand. It's very consistent with that observation plus what we're proposing. It makes some sense.
You know what we like to say in our solar system? If you have water, you have carbon. You have the two. You know where I'm heading on this?
I do.
Is life possible somewhere? You have the, you know, in the shadows of the boundaries of the shadows of that hot planet?
Well, only if you can survive 800 degrees Fahrenheit and maybe about 4,000 or 5,000 degrees, even higher because of the impact process. Yeah, I don't think there's much left up there. I think these are the, as you said, these are the ashes.
Would there be enough diamonds? I know, because we have people's interest now. We're talking diamonds. To mine Mercury, to send a probe now to, you know, go to the surface and mine Mercury for diamonds or something like that.
Oh, I wish I could say that. You know, we'd have a brand new space program. But no, I don't think there's enough. But it does kind of give you pause to think that we might have this diamond-studded black planet. It's really fun. And every time I think about this, I want to start singing the Rolling Stones song, you know, paint it black.
Go ahead. Give it a few.
No, bombs. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that.
Oh, shucks.
That'll teach me.
Well, so, you know, what's always fascinating about these things, we always thought that Mercury is just, years ago, was just a crispy little critter, right? He's just sitting there baking next to the Earth. But it's got a little more character to it than we thought.
Much more character. I think we knew a lot from the Mariner 10 mission to Mercury in the 70s. But MESSENGER and this new understanding shows that it's a very strange place with a magnetic field that's three times stronger in the north than it is elsewhere on the planet. And it's still shrinking. It has this tremendous core and a very thin crust. So it's a very strange place.
What do you mean it's still shrinking?
Well, it turns out that Mercury, and we knew this actually from in the 70s, that Mercury had these big giant faults that apparently are related to the whole planet gradually shrinking and creating them. But we didn't know for sure. MESSENGER pretty well nailed this.
Hmm. And is there still to learn about this planet?
Oh, I think there's still a lot more to learn. I think the composition of some of those organics in the poles, I think to get a better sense for the magnetic field and exactly why, there's a paper out that suggests why, because it's very different from the Earth. Mm-hmm. So we're still trying to figure it out. I mean, there's estimates that the ices that are stored in the poles of Mercury may be equivalent to the volume in Lake Ontario in the United States. So there may be water there at tremendous levels, but, wow. I mean, we just need to know what else is there.
Wow, that is fascinating. Thank you. Thank you, Peter Schultz, for enlightening us and making us wonder even more about Mercury. Have a good weekend. Thanks a lot.
Okay,
Peter Schultz,
much.
Research professor of Earth Environment and Planetary Sciences at Brown University. Coming up, we're talking about turning bad science into comedy. Sounds sort of like this show. It's a satirical science festival, BaFest. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you've ever wondered what the evolutionary origins of the spare tire is, you know, that stubborn ring of belly fat common in men of a certain age, yours truly, science finally has your answer.
As the human male ages, we begin to see a donut-shaped belt of tissue around the midsection. Now, this is a flotation device. The entire reason why our species was able to survive in early river civilizations.
Of course, a flotation device, a stomach Mae West. Now, if your BS detector is beeping right now, that's a sign it is in good working order. That presentation, titled The Abdominal Torus, Adapted Speciation in Midlife Human Males, it wasn't presented at any scientific conference. It was the winning talk at BaFest, the satirical science festival that challenges science fans to construct real arguments for completely bogus hypotheses. Joining me now to talk about some of those BAS, or bad ad hoc hypotheses, is the founder of BaFest, Zach Wienersmith. He's creator of the science-savvy webcomic Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. He joins me from Houston. Zach, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
How did you come? You're welcome. How did you come up with this idea?
It was actually originally a comic. It was originally in the comic called The Festival of Ad Hoc Bad Adaptationist Hypotheses, which was even more clumsy. It was a joke about this concept of adaptationism, which is sort of an insult in biology. It means, you know, just so stories, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
So how does it work? You the idea is to win an argument using fake science?
Yeah, we have people propose... not real theories. You come up with a hypothesis that is fairly clearly wrong, and then you support it the best you can using empirical evidence, like from real studies. And we've even had people make agent-based models and complicated differential equation models to support their theories. And then the goal is, after questioning from our judges, to be shown to be the best bogus theory.
Let me give an idea. You had the idea for the festival came from a bad ad hoc hypothesis that you had, and you called it the infant defaulting hypothesis. What's infant defaulting? What is that?
Yes, it's the theory that a lot of characteristics of babies can be explained if you assume our ancestors catapulted babies to distant villages in order to reach genetically distinct populations for mating purposes, to spread their genes.
Hmm. And so you can make a case for that.
I have a very good case. I have excellent evidence. For one, babies are largely hairless, unlike adult humans, which is obviously adapted for aerodynamics.
Right.
And what's really interesting, I was talking to a friend in avionics about this, and babies, you'll note, only have hair on their heads. And actually, you know how it's kind of like the dimples on a golf ball. If you hit a golf ball, it has these dimples, and what they do is they reduce the wake behind the ball so you get less turbulence. And similarly, a little bit of hair on the spherical head of a baby should actually narrow the wake to reduce turbulence. It's probably the most parsimonious explanation.
So you sort of take real facts and you just craft them to fit your bogus hypothesis.
Pretty much, yeah. We take real facts or we leave out real facts.
Oh, I see.
That's the most common strategy is leaving out all the good countervailing evidence.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring on another voice into our conversation, and that is Sarah Hurd. She's a postdoctoral fellow at UC Davis Genome Center in Davis, California. She was also the winner of the West Coast BAFest last year. Her talk was entitled, "Why Do Mammals Sleep?" Welcome to Science Friday, Sarah.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You convinced me on that one, why mammals sleep. Can you give us a little thumbnail of what your argument was?
Sure. I proposed that all mammals sleep and that they do this because there's one stressor that we all share but cannot otherwise escape from, and that is ourselves.
Let me play a little bit of that. We actually have your argument at that fest. Mm-hmm. Why mammals sleep?
All animals deal with stress all the time, but most stressors are temporary. We get a signal from something like a predator, we deal with it, and one way or another, it goes away. Life, by definition basically, is the sum of all these stresses. But there's something missing from this picture, and it's a stressor that we all share, we are constantly exposed to, and that is absolutely intolerable 24 hours a day. And that's you.
Yes, there's no escaping yourself.
Exactly.
Well, you chose to answer that question, why do mammals sleep? How did you hit on that one?
You know, I knew that why we sleep was kind of this big unanswered question, and it occurred to me that maybe we can draw patterns between the number of hours an animal spends sleeping and the reason that we see that variation.
Mm-hmm. And that one came to you naturally.
Yeah, right off the bat. Of course.
Tell us about the hypothesis. Lead us into that hypothesis.
Yes, yeah, so the hypothesis is that sleep evolved as this mechanism for us to escape the otherwise inescapable, and that's us.
Right.
There's no other way to escape this stress of our endless thoughts and feelings. So the premise is that animals who sleep more are less satisfied with their life, and animals that sleep less have better lives. And I used kind of the big categories of things that contribute to our quality of life to support this argument.
And yeah, you really put evidence out, right? You showed graphs and things animals.
Yeah. I looked at the categories like habitat and diet and social structure and then compared animals that sleep a lot to animals who sleep a little. So, for example, elephants and giraffes who sleep 4 to 5 hours per day live in these beautiful grassland habitats, whereas bats and possums who sleep 20 hours per day or so live in places like dank caves and garbage cans. So obviously, the amount of sleep is correlated to how much they like things like their living conditions.
Well, I guess the trick here, the talent that you have, is that you take these facts, which they're all true facts, right? But
mm-hmm.
you weave them into something that is untrue. You're sort of
exactly.
cheating that way.
Yeah, it's very easy to cherry pick data and arguments to support a conclusion when you already know the conclusion you want to support.
So you start out with the conclusion, then you go find some facts that you're going to weave into something that supports that
exactly.
bogus conclusion.
Exactly, and the sillier the better.
Zach, how do other BAFest presenters cheat? What are some of the most used strategies?
I would say that the two most used strategies are one, what you just talked about, which is omission. That is to say, you can have a lovely graph. I actually don't know what Sarah omitted, but I'm assuming that beautiful graph she made left out probably 100 million species who did not fit the theory. But the other one that's really popular is intimidation via math. Which is, of course, a common real seminar tactic, which is you throw up some equations and then you say, now you have to believe me because you can't possibly analyze these equations for the duration of this talk.
Right.
Yeah.
You believe anything you see on a slide, right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. No, it's chock full of lies. I actually was talking to someone who I think has been a guest on your show, Justin Werfel. He's been a contestant for us twice, and he had this beautiful graph correlating the length of road in a country to obesity rates. And I asked him, you know, is this real? Because it was a great correlation. And he said, everything on the graph is true. And wouldn't tell me anything else.
Our number, 844-724-8255. Maybe you've been a BaFest presenter, or you'd like to be one, or you have an idea how you might cheat with real graphs. 844-SciTalk is our number. What kind of response, Zach, have you gotten to BaFest? Are you cramming thousands of people in these events, or just 25 or 30 show up?
So I thought that's what would happen. I thought we'd get a couple dozen and we'd do this once. We held our first show at MIT in 2013, and we sold out 1,000 seats. It blew me away. We actually had a professor at one of the second events we invited to be a judge. I won't say who it was, but this professor had thought from our videos that we'd clipped in the audience, like we'd faked it. There are not that many people who are that dorky, but it turns out, at least in Cambridge and San Francisco, there are that many nerds.
And maybe you've got some spillover from the Ig Nobel Prize folks coming over.
I should say Mark Abrahams from the Ig Nobels gave us a lot of really good advice early on about what I'll tell you the best advice he gave us. We were originally going to have the talks. This might terrify Sarah. They were going to be like 20-minute long talks. And he was like, that's the worst idea. So we cut it down to 5 minutes. And I'm so glad. I think we wouldn't have a show if we hadn't followed that advice.
You know, most BaFest talks take aim at evolutionary science. So why is that? Is it just easier to abuse?
I think that's true. I think part of it is biology as a field is very horizontal. That is to say, you can quickly, most people can understand it quickly. You just have to know a lot of stuff. And so it's very accessible. I mean, it's still pretty nerdy, but I think most of the concepts could be accessed by an educated listener. That said, we actually are looking to expand topics in the coming years.
Mm-hmm. What? What would you like to? What topics would you like to include?
We're opening a show in Seattle. Hopefully this winter. We're still figuring out the details, but our theme for that is going to be big science, by which I mean proposals for science projects that cost over $10 billion. So my example that I give is I call it the relativistic refrigerator. And the idea is you can preserve food by accelerating it to close to light speed so that it's in a different reference frame. And then it's always fresh when it comes back to you.
Time will slow down on it.
Exactly. Yeah. It will experience less time. So it'll be like, you know, that's the problem. You just made pie, right? And it's going to you can put it in the fridge, but it's not going to be as good. But if it were in a different reference frame because it was at 0.99 C circling the Earth, it would still be fresh when you got it back. It's the twin paradox, but for pie.
But you'd be too old to eat it.
That is a potential problem. But it would be fresh when you got it, you know. So presumably you keep your health during the 70 years you're waiting for your cherry pie to come home.
Well, you're never too old for pie.
Never.
That's right.
Never too old for pie. We asked another scientist and BaFest presenter, Justin Werfel, why he thinks scientists get a kick out of this. And this is what he told us.
There's an aspect of this that I think of as being like magicians going to a magic show. Like when a magician sees a magic show, they don't say, oh my gosh, that's amazing, this person's doing magic. They say, oh, that's a nice effect. I know how I would have achieved that effect. I wonder how they do it. It's sort of a puzzle.
Is Justin onto something, Sarah?
Sure. Seeing the tricks behind the trade. I think scientists really like BaFest because for several reasons. We're generally frustrated maybe with the lack of scientific understanding, so it's almost cathartic to take these to intentionally take these silly hypotheses to their most extreme conclusion, and seeing how somebody can craft that sort of argument is very entertaining. I also think it's popular because the biological world is so rife with funny things that need explaining that creative scientists come up with ways to present these hypotheses that are just fun.
You know, we've always wondered, we've been on the air almost 25 years, can scientists be funny?
You know? I hope so.
I don't know, maybe this is in their favor. Let's go to the phones, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Austin and then Gillette, Wyoming. Hi, Austin.
Hey, Ira, how are you doing?
Hey there, go ahead.
Oh, so speaking of kind of funny relations, I was thinking of the paradoxical religion came from Oklahoma, I think, the Flying Spaghetti Monster. And what they mm-hmm. did somehow to prove their religion was relate global warming and pirates. Like, the more global warming there was, the more pirates there were. So I thought that was a relatively interesting correlation.
Hmm. Zach, would that work for you?
I don't know if that particular correlation is biologically relevant, but
well, that's part of the
magic.
Actually,
exactly. Yeah, false correlation is a lot of fun. We see plenty of that in our presentation. Sometimes it's very blatant, which is always nice.
What qualifies for you're rejected immediately? I mean, what is really really bad science?
we have gotten some crazy ones. I mean, some are just I don't know what the point was. But actually, the most commonly rejected topics are ones that are a little too sexy for. We shoot for PG-13, and of course, nature is red and tooth and claw and other things, and we can't have that on our PG-13 show.
Yeah,
maybe we'll do an all those presentations one of these days. But
I get you. Yeah. We won't go there. I'm Ira Flatow. Yeah. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about the BAFEST with Zach Wiener-Smith and Sarah Hurd. When are you having the next one? If people are interested and they'd like to go see it, where are you having it?
Yeah, if you go to bahfest.com, that's bahfest.com, we're starting to list our lineup for 2015. We're having one at MIT. It's the third one we've had at MIT. It'll be September 19th. Mm. And on the West Coast, I think we're part of Bay Area Science Festival. I don't know if the date's locked in, but if it is, it'll be on the website. And then we're planning one in Seattle also for winter, but we don't have a date locked mm-hmm. yet.
Sarah, what's scary about this whole thing is that it's almost like this is what we hear in real life all the time. People
yes.
using almost data to try to prove something that doesn't work, but they just snow us with this stuff. How do you know if your BS meter should be hitting red?
You know, that is an excellent question, and I think people should think about that more when they hear, sensational headlines about things that can cure cancer or weight loss and all those sorts of things. My tactic is to try to look at the data that is supporting the headlines instead of just digesting the headlines as patently true, because people do exaggerate and people do draw conclusions from just, two data points that have nothing to do with each other.
Mm-hmm. Especially in this political season.
Yes, exactly.
Let me see if I can get a quick call in before we go. David in Cleveland. Hi, David.
Hello. It's amusing, of course, but I was wondering on a more serious note, even though these proposals are obviously fabricated, completely specious, has there ever been a case where one of them inspired one of the audience or listener or some other science participant to think up something that actually turned out to be a true scientific theory or breakthrough?
Great question, Zach.
Yeah, it's part of why it appeals to me, because in real science you don't get to do a lot of blue sky thinking, or at least that's a sense I get from my wife, who's a biologist. But we actually had one person, or two people now, who have said, I started working on a theory as a joke, and then the evidence started to convince me, so I had to submit something else. so it's at least getting people to think. I don't know if I want to take responsibility for those theories, but it's nice to get people to think.
Wow, so they thought they had started out with a BAFEST baddie, and it turned out to have some real relevance.
Well, maybe.
Maybe.
It remains to be seen.
Yeah. Well, we will look forward to your next BAFEST. Good luck to both of you. And Sarah, are you going to be presenting at all in a new one? Do you have any new ideas?
I don't think so, but I might be a judge this year. Ah. I do have some other ideas, but
all right.
Some other year.
We'll keep watching. Sarah Hurd is a winner of last year's West Coast BAFEST. She's a postdoctoral fellow at the UC Davis Genome Center. And Zach Wiener-Smith is founder of BAFEST and creator of the webcomic Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Good
Thank
luck.
Thanks for having us.
Have a good weekend. We're going to take a break and come back with an update in cancer immunotherapy, using your own immune system to battle the disease. There's some very intriguing preliminary evidence about how to do that to make the cancer therapy for your own disease. We'll talk about that after the break, so stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Immunotherapy is one of the hottest areas of research in cancer treatments. Instead of injecting patients with highly toxic drugs, the idea is to get the immune system to battle the disease. And one group has been looking at melanoma patients. The researchers use the mutations of the patient's own tumors to hopefully trigger their T cells to fight and attack the tumors. It was a small study, just 3 patients. Their disease is stable. It's too early to say if this treatment was responsible, but it is a step in building personalized therapies. And the group published their results this week in the journal Science. My next guests are here to talk about this latest edition in cancer immunotherapy research. Beatrice Careno is the lead author on that science study. She's also an associate professor of medicine at Washington University's School of Medicine in St. Louis. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome. Nicholas Restefo is a principal investigator at the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, Maryland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good to be here, Ira.
Our number 844-724-SciTalk. Also, you can tweet us at SciFry. Dr. Restefo, can you give us a basic idea of how these immunotherapies operate?
These immunotherapies are based on T lymphocytes, part of our immune system, which in day-to-day life are the things that protect us from viruses. But what they're also able to do is they're able to attack and destroy tumors. And using a variety of techniques, we're able to stimulate these lymphocytes we're going to hear about vaccines in a few minutes, or by taking those lymphocytes out and expanding them outside of the patient's body and then reinfusing them into patients and having them kill tumor. And as you said in your introduction, it's a potentially a much less toxic way of mm-hmm. dealing with this because it's utterly specific for just the tumor.
Mm-hmm. Don't the cancers usually find a way? I mean, isn't this part of the problem in attacking a cancer with your own body, that the cancer has a way of hiding from the immune system?
It sure. certainly does, yes.
Dr. Careno, you want to jump in?
Well, I just want to say that, yes, there are the cancer have found many ways to get around the immune response to hide from it. But we're also learning how to reveal the tumor to the immune system by using antibodies that target some molecules on the surface of these T cells that Dr. Restefo referred to, and take the break off of the immune system and then allow the T cells to recognize that the tumor is there. So we not only have vaccines and this adoptive cell transfer, but we also have antibodies that can also modulate the response that might be happening in the patients.
Mm-hmm. You use the tumor mutations. A lot of us aren't familiar with how cancer operates, but the tumors have mutations on them, correct?
That's correct.
And that's how the T cells can identify them being cancerous?
Right. So one of the challenges making cancer vaccines has been what to use as a target to wake up the immune system. And we, as part of this tumor development process, there is damage that is done to the cancer cell, and this DNA damage turns into protein alterations that probably are seen foreign by the immune system. And we have known that this is probably something that we could exploit to wake up the immune system. But the question was, how can we systematically characterize those mutations? And it hasn't been until now where we have the technology now where we can systemically catalog all the mutations that is present in one tumor. And then we can inquire and predict maybe which of those mutations will be seen by the immune system as foreign. So that's what our paper is about. Looking at the mutations, identifying the mutations, making predictions, and then testing in the patients which ones can wake up the immune system, these T cells that will have a protective effect,
hopefully. So how do you wake up the T cells or the immune system to go after and recognize these mutations in the tumor.
Yes. So in our case, the way we went about making the vaccine is we use another kind of immune cell that is called a dendritic cell. These cells are kind of sentinels of the immune system. They go around checking for foreign matters, and their function really is to activate T cells when you have an infection or any kind of pathogens. But we can also take advantage of those cells, and we can grow them ex vivo outside the patients, and then we can kind of decorate them with these mutations that we get from the sequencing the genome, and we present these mutations in the form of peptides, and then we can give them back to the patients as an infusion, and these cells then can trigger an immune response.
So they have little flags on them now.
They're like little flags that say, hey, I'm here, and then they call to the immune response so that the immune response can get set up and started.
And you tried this out on three patients so far.
We did, yes. We tried it in three patients that had their tumor resected, and they get three different vaccinations over a period of 18 weeks. And then we use immunological methods in the lab to track that immune response is happening. And what was fascinating from these vaccine results is that we found that there could be some pre-existing immunity to some of these mutations. So some mutations trigger a naturally occurring response, and they're there before the vaccine. But once we get the vaccine, we reveal responses to mutations that for reasons that are not clear to us, the immune system mm-hmm. was ignoring. So we create like a little army now of cells that can see these tumors.
And how successful were you in these three patients?
Meaning from an immunological
yes.
standpoint?
I mean, did it work, I guess is what I'm asking.
Yes. So for every patient that we had, we picked seven mutations, and out of the seven mutations that we picked, three of them turned out to promote an immune response. And if you think of all the requirements that are necessary to see the development of an immune response, I think we were pretty successful because we got three out of seven. I don't know. I would like to get Dr. Restifo's opinion on this.
Yes, I think... I think from an immunological point of view, I think Dr. Carreno's finding is convincingly shows that you can expand these anti-tumor T cells in the body. I think what you may be asking, though, and what listeners are very interested in is, does it make your cancer go away? And I think, you know, that is a much harder question to answer, and it's going to take... it's going to take a lot more patience, and it's going to take a lot of effort. Mm-hmm. But the idea that the immune system can indeed recognize mutated antigens is now gaining foothold, and we know this can happen. Our particular technique, also published in Science yesterday, in a review article, we take the patient's own lymphocytes and expand them up outside of the patient's body, and then reinfuse them back into the patient, where in large cohorts of patients, we can show that these T cells can actually cause long-term, durable responses in patients with lots of cancer.
So you're helping the body by giving it an injection back of its own stuff, but magnified.
Well, there's an important step here that the tumor may have T cells inside of it, but there are a number of reasons why those that we understand from laboratory studies for why those T cells are not killing the tumor. One of them is the so-called checkpoint blockades that Beatrice was alluding to earlier. The other is that there are cells in there. It's sort of like the mafia. It sort of takes over the immune system and corrupts the immune system and prevents your immune system from killing it. Mm. And that's how it grows and spreads through the body. Mm. And so part of the treatment that that we're employing temporarily takes away your immune system, ironically. to treat the tumor, basically, we temporarily eliminate the immune system, and then we reinfuse just the anti-tumor T cells without any of these other corrupted cells, and they can then go in and destroy the cancer.
Have you had success trying this on people?
Yeah.
Dr.
Have we had success? Absolutely. So yes, we and several other groups around the world now are using adoptive cell transfer to treat patients with a variety of cancers. Melanoma, we just published a paper on cervical cancer, but we've also treated patients with leukemias and lymphomas using genetically engineered T cells. We've published treating patients with sarcoma. So I think, you know, we're still treating a very tiny sliver of patients, but it looks to us like the future.
So when
like
can
the future of cancer?
Yeah, well, if it is the future, when does the future get here?
It's a slow process.
Yeah, I think the technique that Dr. Restifo is referring to of adoptive cell transfer was something that they started investigating over maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and now they're having great success. Part of those cells that are there are also cells that are seeing mutations. So I think for those of us that work on the vaccine field, you know, there has been it has been a harder road because until now we didn't have appropriate targets that we could use to activate the immune mm-hmm. system. We now think that these mutations might be the ideal candidates to get a boost.
This is really personalized medicine because everybody's tumor is going to be different.
Absolutely.
You would have to do this differently for every single person who has some kind of cancer.
It couldn't be more personalized. Yeah. But that's in part the... before we have tried to use antigens or flags that are shared between individuals, and the problem is that they're also shared with the normal cells, and the immune response have not been a strong immune response. So we think that it is personalized, but it might be beneficial.
But are you going to be able to get a drug company interested in something that's so personalized?
That's one of the issues. It's a bespoke therapy for each person. Yeah. And drug companies, the normal model is that they produce a pill or an injection. It's off the shelf, and then it's given to everyone. Well, everyone's cancers, it turns out, have different mutations, and some of these mutations are what we call stochastic. We can use that word on Science Friday. Just random, and so everyone's tumor is different, and so this doesn't really fit the normal model for drug companies where one, it's sort of a drug. You take the drug and it does its effect. This is a unique product for each patient.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
It's a very difficult situation.
It will probably require a complete different approach to the way we see pharmaceuticals. But I think the time will tell. There was a time when we were... thinking about antibodies, and people were hesitant of using antibodies in cancer, and you can see the success that checkpoint inhibitors have. So I do agree it's different, but mm-hmm. I think this is a new paradigm
All right.
In treating cancer.
We're going to hope right along with you, Dr. Carano. Beatrice Carano
is
Associate Professor of Medicine at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. Nicholas Restifo is a Principal Investigator at the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks.
One last thing. Deodorant companies spend boatloads of cash convincing you to use their spray, their roll-on, speed stick, whatever, to hide the smell of your armpits. The stink is produced by millions of bacteria that thrive there.
We have these amazing organs in our armpits called axillary organs, and as far as we know, they have no function other than to feed bacteria.
That's Rob Dunn, microbiome researcher at North Carolina State University. Which bacteria? Scientists at the University of York have identified a leading candidate, a beastie called Staphylococcus hominis. The York scientists have figured out the gene that is the go-between between the food we give that microbe and the odor they produce. Why do we have bacteria living there? Why do we need to feed and nourish them? It's all part of the smelly mystery of life.
In truth, the mystery is that we expend lots of bodily energy, valuable nutrients, in feeding microbes in our armpits. And that rather than figuring out how to fix the fact that it's stinky, it behooves us to understand why it's evolved to be stinky in the first place. And when we cover up the stink, what are we doing? And that's a story we're just beginning to figure out.
And when they've solved the riddle of stinky armpits, perhaps they'll head over to the place on your body most microbiologically like your armpit, your belly button. We won't go there right now, but we will say adios this hour. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to the production partners at the studios of City University of New York. If you missed any part of our program, go to our website at sciencefriday.com. And if you're a trivia diehard, you're not alone. Here at Science Friday, we've got a bunch of trivia nerds. I caught them playing in the office just the other day.
All right, everyone. Name what movie this tagline is from. He is afraid. He is alone. He is 3 million light years from home.
Planet of the Apes.
Yes. Nope. It's E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Sorry. Danielle wins.
She's always winning. If you want to play along, too, get in on the game at the first ever Science Friday Trivia Night. That's May 13th at the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York. That's right here in Brooklyn. Tickets and more at sciencefriday.com/trivia. May 13th, SciFry's first trivia night. In the meantime, if you're celebrating, have a great Passover and Easter. Have a great holiday weekend anytime. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.